This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Every Breath, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by Sean Cameron Michael and Vanessa Johansson, with an introduction by Nicholas Sparks.
For Victoria Vodar. Kindred Spirit. There are stories that rise from mysterious unknown places and others that are discovered, a gift from someone else. This story is one of the latter. On a cool and blustery day in the late spring of 2016, I drove to Sunset Beach, North Carolina, one of many small islands between Wilmington and the South Carolina border. I parked my truck near the pier and hiked down the beach, heading for Bird Island, an uninhabited coastal preserve. Locals had told me there was something I should see. Perhaps, they'd even suggested, the site would end up in one of my novels. They told me to keep my eye out for an American flag. When I spotted it in the distance, I'd know I was getting close. Not long after the flag came into view, I kept my eyes peeled. I was to look for a mailbox called Kindred Spirit. The mailbox, planted on a pole of aging driftwood near a sawgrass-speckled dune, has been around since 1983 and belongs to no one and everyone. Anyone can leave a letter or a postcard. Any passerby can read whatever has been placed inside. Thousands of people do so every year. Over time, Kindred Spirit has been a repository of hopes and dreams in written form. And always, there are love stories to be found. The beach was deserted. As I approached the isolated mailbox on its lonely stretch of shoreline, I could just make out a wooden bench beside it. It was the perfect resting place, an outpost of reflection. Reaching inside the mailbox, I found two postcards, several previously opened letters, a recipe for Brunswick stew, a journal that appeared to have been written in German, and a thick manila envelope. There were pens, a pad of unused paper, and envelopes, presumably for anyone who's inspired to add their own story to the contents. Taking a seat on the bench, I perused the postcards and the recipe before turning to the letters. Almost immediately, I noticed that no one used last names. Some of the letters had first names, others had only initials, and still others were completely anonymous, which only added to the sense of mystery. But anonymity seemed to allow for candid reflection. I read about a woman who, in the aftermath of a struggle with cancer, had met the man of her dreams at a Christian bookstore, but worried that she wasn't good enough for him. I read about a child who hoped to one day become an astronaut. There was a letter from a young man who planned to propose to his sweetheart in a hot air balloon, and still another from a man who wanted to ask his neighbor on a date, but feared rejection. There was a letter from someone recently released from prison who wanted nothing more than to start his life over. The final missive was from a man whose dog, Teddy, had recently been put to sleep. The man was still grieving, and after finishing the letter, I studied the photograph that had been tucked inside the envelope, showing a black Labrador retriever with friendly eyes and a graying muzzle. The man had signed his initials AK, and I found myself hoping he would find a way to fill the void that Teddy's absence had left behind. By then, the breeze was steady and the clouds had begun to darken. A storm was rolling in. I returned the recipe, postcards, and letters to the mailbox and debated opening the manila envelope. The thickness indicated a substantial number of pages, and the last thing I wanted was to get caught in the rain as I trekked back to my truck. Flipping over the envelope as I debated, I saw that someone had printed on the back, "The most amazing story ever." A plea for recognition? A challenge? Written by the author or by someone who'd examined the contents? I wasn't sure, but how could I resist? I opened the clasp. Inside the envelope were a dozen or so pages, photocopies of three letters, and some photocopied drawings of a man and woman who clearly looked to be in love with each other. I set those aside and reached for the story. The first line made me pause. "The destiny that matters most in anyone's life is the one concerning love." The tone was unlike the previous letters, promising something grand, it seemed. I settled in to read. After a page or so, my curiosity became interest. After a few more pages, I couldn't put the story aside. Over the next half hour, I laughed and felt my throat tighten. I ignored the uptick in the breeze and clouds that were turning the color of charcoal. Thunder and flickers of lightning were reaching the distant edge of the island when I read the final words with a sense of wonder. I should have left then. I could see sheets of rain marching across the waves toward me, but instead, I read the story a second time. On that reading, I was able to hear the voices of the characters with utter clarity. By the time I read the letters and examined the drawings, I could feel the idea taking shape that I might somehow find the writer and broach the possibility of turning his story into a book. But finding that person wouldn't be easy. Most of the events had taken place long in the past, more than a quarter century earlier, and instead of names, there were only single initials. Even in the letters, the original names had been whited out before the pages were copied. There was nothing to indicate who the writer or artist might have been. A few clues remained, however. In the part of the story dating back to 1990, there was mention of a restaurant with a deck out back and an indoor fireplace, where a cannonball allegedly salvaged from one of Blackbeard's ships sat atop the mantle. There was also reference to a cottage on an island off the North Carolina coast within walking distance of the restaurant. And, in what seemed to be the most recently written pages, the writer spoke of a construction project currently underway at a beach house on a different island altogether. I had no idea whether the project was now finished, but I had to start somewhere. Though years had passed, I hoped the drawings would eventually help me identify the subjects. And, of course, there was also the Kindred Spirit mailbox on the beach where I sat, which played a pivotal role in their story. By then, the sky was positively threatening, and I knew I was out of time. Sliding the pages back into the manila envelope, I returned it to the mailbox and hurried to my truck. I barely beat the downpour. Had I waited another few minutes, I would have been drenched, and, despite having my windshield wipers on high, I could barely see through the glass. I drove home, made myself a late lunch, and stared out the window, continuing to think about the couple that I'd read about on the pages. By evening, I knew that I wanted to go back to Kindred Spirit and examine the story again, but weather and some business travel prevented me from returning for nearly a week. When I finally made it back, the other letters, the recipe, and the journal were there, but the manila envelope was gone. I wondered what had become of it. I was curious as to whether a stranger had been as moved by the pages as I'd been and had taken them, or if, perhaps, there was some sort of caretaker who occasionally purged the mailbox. Mainly, I wondered whether the author had had second thoughts about revealing the story and come to retrieve it himself. It made me want to talk to the writer even more, but family and work kept me busy for another month, and it wasn't until June that I found time to begin my quest. I won't bore you with all the details regarding my search. It took the better part of a week, countless phone calls, visits to various chambers of commerce and county offices where building permits were recorded, and hundreds of miles on the truck. Since the first part of the story took place decades ago, some of the reference points had long since disappeared. I managed to track down the location of the restaurant. It was now a chic seafood bistro with white tablecloths, and used that as a starting point for my exploratory excursions in order to get a sense of the area. After that, following the trail of building permits, I visited one island after the next, and on one of my many walks up and down the beach, I eventually came across the sound of hammering in a power drill, not uncommon for salted and weather-beaten homes along the coast. When I saw an older man working on a ramp that led from the top of the dune to the beach, though, I felt a sudden jolt. I remembered the drawings and, even from a distance, suspected that I had found one of the characters I had read about. Walking over, I introduced myself. Up close, I became even more certain it was him. I noted the quiet intensity I'd read about and the same observant blue eyes referenced in one of the letters. Doing the math, I figured him to be in his late 60s, which was the right age. After a bit of small talk, I asked him point blank whether he'd written the story that had ended up in Kindred Spirit. In response, He deliberately turned his gaze toward the ocean, saying nothing for perhaps a minute. When he turned to face me again, he said that he would answer my questions the following afternoon, but only if I was willing to lend him a hand on his construction project. I showed up with a tool belt early the following morning, but the tools proved unnecessary. Instead, he had me haul plywood, 2x4s, and pressure-treated lumber from the front of the house to the back, up and over the sandy dune and onto the beach. The pile of lumber was enormous, and the sand made every load seem twice as heavy. It took me most of the day, and aside from telling me where to place the lumber, he didn't speak to me at all. He spent the day drilling and nailing and working beneath a searing, early summer sun, more interested in the quality of his work than my presence. Shortly after I'd finished hauling the last load, he motioned for me to take a seat on the dune and opened a cooler. Filling a pair of plastic cups from a thermos inside, he handed me a cup of iced tea. "Yeah," he finally offered. "I wrote it." "Is it true?" He squinted as if evaluating me. "Some of it," he admitted in the accent I'd heard described in the pages. "Some might dispute the facts, but memories aren't always about facts." I told him that I thought it might make for a fascinating book and launched into a series of passionate arguments. He listened in silence, his expression unreadable. For some reason, I felt anxious, almost desperate, to persuade him. After an uncomfortable silence during which he seemed to be weighing my proposition, he finally spoke. He was willing to discuss the idea further and perhaps even agree to my request, but only on the condition that he be the first to read the story, and if he didn't like it, he wanted me to bury the pages. I hedged. Writing a book takes months, even years, of effort, but he held firm. In the end, I agreed. Truth be told, I understood his reasoning. If our positions had been reversed, I would have asked the same of him. We went to the cottage then. I asked questions and received answers. I was provided again with a copy of the story, and I was shown the original drawings and letters that enlivened the past even more. The conversation rolled on. He told the story well and saved the best for last. As evening fell, he showed me a remarkable item, a labor of love, that enabled me to visualize the events with detail and clarity, as if I'd been a witness to all that happened. I also began to see how the words would appear on the page, as if the story were writing itself and my role was simply to transcribe it. Before I left, he requested that real names not be used. He had no desire for fame. He considered himself a private person, but more than that, he knew that the story had the potential to open old and new wounds. The events, after all, hadn't taken place in isolation. There were living people involved, some of whom might be upset by the revelations. I have honored his request because I believe that the story has larger value and meaning, the power to remind us that there are times when destiny and love collide. I began working on the novel soon after that first evening we spent together. In the year that followed, whenever I had questions, I called or visited. I toured the locations, or at least those that hadn't been lost to history. I went through newspaper archives and examined photographs that had been taken more than 25 years earlier. To flesh out even more details, I spent a week at a bed and breakfast in a small coastal town in eastern North Carolina and traveled as far as Africa. I was fortunate in that time seems to move more slowly in both those regions. There were moments when I felt as if I'd actually journeyed deep into the past. My trip to Zimbabwe was especially helpful. I'd never been to that particular country and was overwhelmed by the spectacular wildlife. The country had once been called the breadbasket of Africa, but by the time of my visit, much of the agricultural infrastructure had decayed and the economy had collapsed for largely political reasons. I walked among crumbling farmhouses and fallow fields, dependent on my imagination as to how verdant the land had been when the story first began. I also spent 3 weeks on various safaris, absorbing everything around me. I spoke to guides and scouts and spotters, discussing their training and their daily lives. I speculated on how challenging it must be for them to maintain families, since they spend most of their time in the bush. I confess, I found Africa utterly seductive. Since those trips, I've often felt the urge to return, and I know I will before long. In spite of all the research, there's much that remains unknown. 27 years is a long period of time, and to recreate verbatim an ancient conversation between two people is impossible. Nor is it possible to recall with accuracy each and every step a person takes, or the position of the clouds in the sky, or the rhythms of the waves as they roll up on the shore. What I can say is that what follows next is the best I can possibly do under such constraints. Since I made further alterations for the purposes of privacy, I'm comfortable describing this book as a novel and not a work of nonfiction. The genesis, research, and creation of this book has been one of the more memorable experiences of my life. In some ways, it's transformed the way I think about love. I suspect that most people harbor a lingering sense of, what if I'd followed my heart? And there's no way to ever really know the answer. A life, after all, is simply a series of little lives, each of them lived one day at a time, and every single one of those days has choices and consequences. Piece by piece, those decisions help to form the people we become. I've captured some fragments to the best of my ability, but who is to say that the picture I've assembled is a true portrait of who the couple really was? There will always be doubters when it comes to love. Falling in love is the easy part. Making that love last amidst life's varied challenges is an elusive dream for many. But if you hear this story with the same sense of wonder that I felt when writing it, then perhaps your faith in the uncanny force that love can exert on people's lives will be renewed. You might even find your own way to kindred spirit one day with a story of your own to tell, one that has the power to change someone else's life in ways you never imagined possible. Nicholas Sparks, September 2nd, 2017.
Part 1. True. On the morning of September 9, 1990, True Walls stepped outside and surveyed a morning sky that was the color of fire near the horizon. The earth was cracked beneath his feet, and the air was dry. It hadn't rained in more than 2 months. Dust clung to his boots as he made his way to the pickup he'd owned for more than 20 years. Like his footwear, the truck was covered in dust both inside and out. Beyond a fence topped with electric wire, an elephant pulled branches from a tree that had toppled earlier that morning. True paid it no attention. It was part of the landscape of his birth. His ancestors had emigrated from England more than a century earlier, and he was no more startled than a fisherman spotting a shark as the daily catch was pulled in. He was lean, with dark hair and squint lines at the corners of his eyes, earned by a life spent in the sun. At 42, he sometimes wondered whether he'd chosen to live in the bush, or the bush had chosen him. The camp was quiet. The other guides, including Romy, his best friend, had left earlier that morning for the main lodge, where they would ferry guests from around the world into the bush. True had worked at the lodge in Awungi National Park for the past 10 years. Prior to that, his existence had been more nomadic, with changes in lodges every couple of years as he gained more experience. As a rule, he'd avoided only those lodges that allowed hunting, something his grandfather wouldn't understand. His grandfather, who was referred to by everyone as the Colonel, though he never served in the military, claimed to have killed more than 300 lions and cheetahs in his lifetime, while protecting livestock in the massive family farm near Harare, where True had been raised. His stepfather and half-brothers were steadily making progress toward that same number. In addition to cattle, True's family cultivated various crops, harvesting more tobacco and tomatoes than any other farm in the country. Coffee, too. His great-grandfather had worked with the legendary Cecil Rhodes, mining magnate, politician, and emblem of British imperialism, accumulating land, money, and power in the late 19th century, before True's grandfather took over. His grandfather, the Colonel, inherited a thriving enterprise from his father. But after World War II, the business expanded exponentially, making the Walls family one of the wealthiest in the country. The colonel had never understood True's desire to escape what was by then a bona fide business empire and life of considerable luxury. Before he'd died, True had been 26 at the time, he'd once visited a reserve where True had been working. Though he had slept at the main lodge rather than the guide camp, seeing True's living quarters had been a shock to the old man. He'd surveyed a dwelling that he probably regarded as little better than a shack, without insulation or telephones. A kerosene lantern provided lighting, and a small communal generator powered a miniature refrigerator. It was a far cry from the home where True had been raised, but the austere surroundings were all True needed, especially as evening descended and an ocean of stars appeared overhead. In fact, they were a step up from a few of the previous camps where he'd worked. In two of those, he'd slept in a tent. Here, at least, there was running water and a shower, which he considered something of a luxury, even if they were in a communal bathroom. On this morning, True carried his guitar in its battered case, a lunchbox and thermos, a handful of drawings he'd made for his son Andrew, and a knapsack containing a few days' worth of clothing, toiletries, drawing pads, colored and charcoal pencils, and his passport. Though he'd be gone for about a week, he figured it was all he would need. His truck was parked beneath a baobab tree. A few of his fellow guides were fond of the dry, pulpy fruit. They'd mix it into their porridge in the morning, but True had never developed a taste for it. Tossing his knapsack onto the front seat, he checked the bed of the truck, making sure there was nothing in the back that could be stolen. Though he'd leave the truck at the family farm, there were more than 300 field workers there, all of whom made very little money. Good tools were prone to vanishing into the ether, even under the watchful eyes of his family. He slid behind the wheel and slipped on his sunglasses. Before turning the key, he made sure he hadn't forgotten anything. There wasn't much. In addition to the knapsack and guitar, he carried with him the letter and photograph he'd received from America, along with his plane tickets and his wallet. In the rack behind him was a loaded rifle, in case his truck broke down and he found himself wandering in the bush, which remained one of the most dangerous places in the world, especially at night, even for someone as experienced as he. In the glove compartment were a compass and a flashlight. He made sure his tent was beneath the seat, again in case of emergency. It was compact enough to fit in the bed of his truck, and though it wouldn't do much to keep predators at bay, it was better than sleeping on the ground. All right then, he thought. He was as ready as he'd ever be. The day was already growing warm and the interior of the truck was even hotter. He'd avail himself of the 220 air conditioning. Two windows down at the speed of 20 miles an hour. It wouldn't help much, but he'd long since grown used to the heat. He rolled up the sleeves of his tan button-up shirt. He wore his usual trekking pants, which had grown soft and comfortable over the years. The guests hanging around the swimming pool back at the main lodge would likely be in bathing suits and flip-flops, but he'd never been comfortable in that attire. The boots and canvas pants had once saved his life, when he'd crossed paths with an angry black mamba. If he hadn't had the proper clothing, the venom would have killed him in less than 30 minutes. He glanced at his watch. It was little after 7, and he had a long couple of days ahead. Cranking the engine, he backed out before heading toward the gate. He hopped out, pulled the gate open, rolled the truck through, and then closed the gate again. The last thing the other guides needed was to return to camp and find that a pride of lions had settled in. It had happened before. Not at this particular camp, but at another where he'd worked, in the southeastern part of the country. That had been a chaotic day. No one had been quite sure what to do other than to bide their time until the lions figured out how long they intended to stay. Fortunately, the lions had vacated the camp to go on the hunt later in the afternoon. But ever since then, True made a point to check the gates, even when he wasn't driving. Some of the guides were new, and he didn't want to take any chances. Shifting the truck into gear, he settled in, trying to make the ride as smooth as possible. The first 100 miles were on rutted gravel roads, pocked with potholes, first in the reserve then winding past a number of small villages. That part would take until the early afternoon, but he was used to the drive, and he allowed his mind to wander as he took in the world he called home. The sun glinted through wispy clouds that trailed over the tree line, illuminating a lilac-breasted roller as it broke free from the tree branches on his left. Two warthogs crossed the road ahead of him, trotting past a family of baboons. He'd seen those animals thousands of times, but he still marveled at how they could survive when surrounded by so many predators. Nature had its own insurance policy, he knew. Animals that were low in the food chain had more young. Female zebras, for instance, were pregnant for all but 9 or 10 days a year. It was estimated that female lions, on the other hand, had to mate more than 1,000 times for every cub that reached its first birthday. It was evolutionary balance at its finest, and though we witnessed it daily, it still struck him as extraordinary. Often guests would ask him about the most exciting things he'd seen while guiding. He'd recount what it was like to be charged by a black rhino, or how he'd once witnessed a giraffe bucking wildly, until finally giving birth in an explosive discharge that had surprised him in its violence. He'd seen a jaguar cub dragging a warthog nearly twice its size high into a tree, only inches ahead of a pack of snarling hyenas who'd caught the scent of the kill. One time he'd followed a wild dog that, abandoned by its own kind, had bonded with a pack of jackals, the same pack it used to hunt. The stories were endless. Was it possible, he wondered, to experience the same game drive twice? The answer was both yes and no. A person could go to the same lodge, work with the same guide, leave at the same time, and drive the same roads in exactly the same weather in the same season, but always the animals were in different places doing different things. They moved to and from watering holes, watching and listening, eating and sleeping and mating, all of them simply trying to survive another day. Off to the side he saw a herd of impalas. Guides would joke that those antelopes were the McDonald's of the bush, fast food in abundance. They were part of every predator's diet, and guests usually grew tired of photographing them after a single game drive. True, however, slowed the truck, watching as one after another made an impossibly high and graceful leap over a fallen tree, as if choreographed. In their own way, he thought, they were as special as the Big Five. Lion, leopard, rhino, elephant, and water buffalo. Or even the Big Seven, which included cheetahs and hyenas. Those were the animals that guests most wanted to see, the game that inspired the most excitement. The thing was, spotting lions wasn't particularly difficult, at least when the sun was shining. Lions slept 18 to 20 hours a day, and they could usually be found resting in the shade. Spotting a moving lion, on the other hand, was rare, except at night. In the past, he'd worked at lodges that offered evening game drives. A few had been hay-raising, and many had been blinding, the dust from 100 buffalo or wildebeest, or zebra swirling as they'd stampeded from lions. It had been impossible to see more than inches in any direction, forcing True to stop the jeep. Twice, he had realized that his vehicle was subtly sandwiched between the pride of lions and whatever they'd been hunting, sending his adrenaline skyrocketing. The road grew steadily rougher, and True slowed even more, weaving from one side to the other. He was headed for Bulawayo, the second largest city in the country, and home to his ex-wife Kim and their son Andrew. He had a house there as well, which he'd bought after his divorce. In retrospect, it was obvious that he and Kim hadn't been well suited for each other. They'd met 10 years ago at a bar in Harare, when True had been between jobs. Later, Kim would tell him that he'd struck her as exotic, which along with his last name was enough to pique her interest. As for her, she was 8 years younger and beautiful, with an easygoing yet confident charm. One thing led to the next, and they ended up spending much of the next 6 weeks together. By then, the bush was calling to True again, and he'd wanted to end the relationship. Instead, she'd told him she was pregnant. They got married. Chu took a job at Awangi because of its relative proximity to Bulawayo, and Andrew came along not long after that. Though she'd known what Chu did for a living, Kim had assumed that when they had a child, Chu would find a job that didn't keep him away for weeks on end. Instead, he continued to guide. Kim eventually met someone else, and their marriage came to an end less than 5 years after it had started. There were no hard feelings on either side. If anything, their relationship had improved since their divorce. Whenever he picked up Andrew, he and Kim would visit for a while, catching up like the old friends they were. She'd remarried and had a daughter with her second husband, Ken. On their last visit, she'd told Tru she was pregnant again. Ken worked in the finance office of Air Zimbabwe. He wore a suit to work and was home every night for dinner. That's what Kim wanted, and Tru was happy for her. As for Andrew, his son was 10 now, and the one great thing to come out of the marriage. As fate would have it, Tru contracted the measles when Andrew was a few months old, leaving him sterile. But he had never felt the need for another child. For him, Andrew had always been more than enough, and he was the reason Tru was detouring to Bulawayo instead of heading straight to the farm. With blonde hair and brown eyes, Andrew resembled his mother, and Tru had dozens of drawings of him tacked to the walls of his shack. Over the years, he'd added photographs. On almost every visit, Kim would hand Tru an envelope filled with them, different versions of his son blending together, evolving into someone entirely new. At least once a week, Tru would sketch something he'd seen in the bush, usually an animal. But other times, he'd draw the two of them, trying to capture a memory from their previous visit. Balancing family and work had been a challenge, especially after the divorce. For 6 weeks while he worked at the camp, Kim had custody, and Chu would be entirely absent from his son's life. No calls, no visits, no impromptu soccer matches or ice cream runs. Then, for 2 weeks, Chu would assume custody and play the role of full-time father. Andrew would stay with him in his house in Bulawayo, Chu ferrying him to and from school, packing lunches and making dinner, and helping with homework. On the weekends, they did whatever Andrew chose, and in each and every one of those moments, Chu would wonder how it was possible to love his son as deeply as he did, even if he wasn't always around to show it. Off to the right, he spotted a pair of circling buzzards, searching for something left over from the hyenas last night, perhaps, or maybe looking for an animal that had died earlier in the morning. Lately, many of the animals had been struggling. The country was in the midst of yet another drought, and the watering holes in this area of the reserve had gone dry. It wasn't surprising. Not far to the west in Botswana lay the vast Kalahari Desert, home of the legendary Bushmen. Their language was thought to be one of the oldest in existence, heavy on knocks and clicks, and sounded almost alien to outsiders. Despite having virtually nothing in the way of material things, they joked and laughed more than any other group of people he'd ever met, but he wondered how long they would be able to maintain their way of life. Modernity was encroaching, and there were rumors that the government of Botswana was going to require that all children in the country be educated in schools, including the Bushmen. He guessed that would eventually spell the end of a culture that had existed for thousands of years. But Africa was always changing. He'd been born in Rhodesia, a colony of the British Empire. He'd watched the country descend into civil unrest, and he'd still been a teenager when the country finally split, eventually becoming the nations of Zimbabwe and Zambia. Like in South Africa, which was regarded as a pariah because of apartheid in much of the civilized world, in Zimbabwe, much of the wealth was concentrated among a tiny percentage of the population, almost all of them white. True doubted that would last forever, but politics and social inequality were subjects he no longer discussed with his family. They were, after all, part of that privileged group, and like all privileged groups, they believed they deserved their riches and advantages, no matter how brutally the original wealth and power might have been accrued. Chu eventually reached the limits of the reserve and passed the first of the small villages, home to about 100 people. Like the guide camp, the village was fenced for the safety of both the people and the animals. He reached for his thermos and took a drink, resting his elbow on the windowsill. He passed a woman on a bicycle, loaded down with boxes of vegetables, then a man who was walking, most likely headed for the next village about 6 miles away. Chu slowed and pulled over. The man ambled to the truck and got in. Chu spoke enough of the man's language to keep a conversation going. In all, he was relatively fluent in 6 languages, 2 of them tribal. The other 4 were English, French, German, and Spanish. It was one of the qualities that made him an employee sought after by lodges. He eventually dropped the man off and continued his drive, finally reaching a road paved in asphalt. He stopped for lunch soon after, simply pulling off the road to eat in the bed of his truck, in the shade of an acacia tree. The sun was high by then, and the world around him was quiet, no animals in sight. Back on the road after lunch, he made better time. The villages eventually gave way to smaller towns, then larger ones, and late in the afternoon he reached the outskirts of Bulawayo. He'd written Kim a letter, telling her when he'd be arriving, but mail in Zimbabwe wasn't always predictable. Letters usually reached their destination, but timeliness wasn't something that could be counted on. Pulling onto a street, he parked behind Kim's car in the driveway. He approached the door and knocked. Moments later she answered, clearly expecting him. As they hugged, Chu heard his son's voice. Andrew tumbled down the stairs, leaping into Chu's arms. Chu knew that the time would come when Andrew considered himself too old for such displays of affection, so he squeezed tighter, wondering whether any joy could ever surpass this. "Mummy told me that you're going to America," Andrew said to him later that night. They were sitting out front on a low wall that served as a fence between Kim's house and the neighbors. "I am, but I'm not staying long. I'll be back next week." "I wish you didn't have to go." Chu slipped his arm around his son. "I know. I'll miss you too." "Then why are you going?" That was the question, wasn't it? Why, after all this time, had the letter arrived, along with a plane ticket? "I'm going to see my father," Chu finally answered. Andrew squinted, his blonde hair bright in the moonlight. "You mean Papa Rodney?" "No," Chu said. "I'm going to see my biological father. I've never met him."
"Do you want to meet him?"
"Yes," Chu thought. "Then, no, not really." "I don't know," he finally admitted.
"Then why are you going?"
"Because," Chu said, "in his letter he told me that he was dying." After saying goodbye to Andrew, Chu drove to his house. Once inside, he opened the windows to air the place out, unpacked his guitar, and played and sang for an hour, before finally turning in for the night. He was out the door early the following morning. Unlike those in the park, the roads to the capital city were relatively well maintained, but it still took most of the day to get there. Chu arrived after dark to see light shining in the stately home that his stepfather Rodney had rebuilt after the fire. Nearby were 3 other houses, one for each of his half-brothers, and the even larger main house, where the colonel had once lived. Technically, Chu owned the main house, but he made his way toward a smaller shack-like structure near the fence line. In the distant past, the bungalow had once housed the chef and his wife. Chu had fixed up the place in his early teen years. While he'd still been alive, the colonel had seen that the bungalow was cleaned somewhat regularly, but that no longer happened. There was dust everywhere, and Chu had to shake the spiders and beetles from the sheets
before crawling into bed. It mattered little to him. He'd slept in worse conditions countless times. In the morning, he avoided his family. Instead, he had Tengwe, the crew foreman, drive him to the airport. Tengwe was gray-haired and wiry, and knew how to coax life out of the ground in the harshest conditions imaginable. His six children worked at the farm, and his wife, Anuna, prepared meals for Rodney. After his mother's death, two had been closer to Tengwe and Anuna than even the colonel, and they were the only ones at the farm he ever missed. The roads in Harare were clogged with cars and trucks, carts and bikes and pedestrians. The airport was even more chaotic. After checking in, Tru boarded a flight that would take him first to Amsterdam, then to New York and Charlotte, and finally to Wilmington, North Carolina. With layovers, he was in transit for nearly 21 hours before he stepped onto U.S. soil for the first time in his life. When he reached the baggage claim area in Wilmington, he spotted a man holding a sign with his name on it, above the name of a limousine service. The driver was surprised by the lack of checked luggage and offered to carry both the guitar case and the knapsack. Tru shook his head. Stepping outside, he could feel his shirt beginning to tack to his back in the thick, humid air as they trudged to the car. The drive was uneventful, but the world beyond the car windows was foreign to him. The landscape, flat and lush and verdant, seemed to stretch in every direction. He saw palms intermingled with oaks and pine trees, and grass the color of emeralds. Wilmington was a small, low-lying city, featuring a mix of chain stores and local businesses that eventually gave way to a historic area, with homes that looked at least a couple of hundred years old. His driver pointed out the Cape Fear River, its brackish waters dotted with fishing boats. On the roads, he saw cars and SUVs and minivans, none of them straddling the lanes as they did in Bulawayo, avoiding carts and animals. No one was riding a bicycle or walking, and nearly every person he saw on the city sidewalks was white. The world he'd left behind felt as distant as a dream. An hour later, Tru crossed a floating pontoon bridge and was dropped off at a three-story home, nestled against a low-rising dune in a place called Sunset Beach, an island just off the coast near the South Carolina border. It took him a moment to understand that the entire bottom floor was comprised of garages. The whole structure seemed almost grotesque compared to the smaller house next door, which displayed a for sale sign out front. He wondered whether the driver had made a mistake, but the driver checked the address again and assured him that he was in the right place. As the car pulled away, he heard the deep rhythmic pulsation of ocean waves rolling ashore. He tried to remember the last time he'd heard that sound. A decade at least, Tru guessed as he climbed the steps to the second floor. The driver had given him an envelope containing the key to the front door, and he stepped past the foyer into an expansive great room with pine flooring and a wood-beamed ceiling. The beach house decor looked like something staged for a magazine, every throw, pillow, and blanket placed with tasteful precision. Large windows offered a view of the back deck and an expanse of seagrass and dunes beyond, stretching to the ocean. A spacious dining area extended off the great room, and the designer kitchen included custom cabinetry, marble countertops, and premium appliances. A note on the counter informed him that the refrigerator and pantry had been stocked with food and drinks, and that if he needed to go anywhere, he could call the limousine company. Should he be interested in ocean activities, a surfboard and fishing gear could be found in the garage. According to the note, Tru's father hoped to arrive on Saturday afternoon. He apologized that he wasn't able to get there sooner, although no explanation was offered for the delay. As he set the note aside, Tru was struck by the idea that perhaps his father was as ambivalent about their meeting as Tru was, which raised the question as to why he'd provided the airline ticket in the first place. Well, Tru would soon find out. It was Tuesday evening, so Tru would have a few days to himself. He hadn't anticipated that, but there wasn't much he could do at this point. He spent the next few minutes exploring the house, learning the layout. The master bedroom was down the hall from the kitchen, and it was there that he left his belongings. Upstairs, there were additional bedrooms and bathrooms, all of which appeared pristine and unused. In the master bathroom, he found fresh towels along with soap, shampoo, and conditioner, and he treated himself to an extra-long shower, lingering beneath the spray. His hair was still damp as he stepped onto the back deck. The air remained warm, but the sun was sinking lower, and the sky had fanned into a thousand shades of yellow and orange. Squinting into the distance, he could just make out what looked to be a pod of porpoises playing in the waves beyond the breakers. A latched gate gave way to steps that descended to a planked walkway over the grasses. Following the steps, he trekked out to the final dune, discovering more steps leading to the beach. There were few people about. In the distance, he saw a woman trailing behind a small dog. In the opposite direction, a few surfers floated on their boards, near a pier that stretched into the ocean like a pointed finger. He started toward the pier, walking on the compact sand near the water's edge, musing that until recently, he'd never heard of Sunset Beach. He wasn't sure he'd ever thought about North Carolina at all. He tried to recall whether any of his guests over the years had come from here, without luck. He supposed it didn't make any difference. At the pier, he took the stairs up and strolled to the end. Resting his arms on the railings, he gazed over water that stretched to the horizon. The sight of it, the immensity of it, was almost beyond comprehension. It reminded him that there was an entire world out there to explore, and he wondered if he would ever get around to doing it. Maybe when Andrew was older, they'd spend some time traveling together. As the breeze picked up, the moon began its slow ascent into an indigo sky. He took it as a cue to head back. He assumed his father owned the place. It might have been a rental, but the furnishings were too pricey to trust to strangers, and besides, if that was the case, why not simply put Drew up at a hotel? He wondered again about the delay until Saturday. Why had he flown Drew out so far in advance? If the man was indeed dying, Drew speculated that it could be something medical, which meant there was no guarantee about Saturday either. But what would happen when his father did show up? The man was a stranger. A single meeting wasn't going to change that. Nonetheless, Drew hoped he'd be able to answer some questions, which was the only reason Drew had decided to come in the first place. Entering the house, he fished out a steak from the refrigerator. He had to open a few of the cabinets before he found a cast-iron fry pan, but the stove, as fancy as it was, functioned similarly to the ones back home. There were also various food items from a place called Murray's Deli, and he added what appeared to be some kind of cabbage salad, as well as potato salad, to his plate. After he ate, he washed the plate, glass, and utensils by hand, and grabbed his guitar before returning to the back deck. He played and sang softly to himself for an hour, while the occasional shooting star passed overhead. He thought about Andrew and Kim, his mother and grandfather, before finally becoming sleepy enough to go to bed. In the morning, he did 100 push-ups and 100 sit-ups before trying and failing to make some coffee. He couldn't figure out how the machine worked. Too many buttons, too many options, and he had no idea where to add the water. He decided to visit the beach instead, hoping to stumble upon a place to buy a cup. Like the evening before, he had the beach mostly to himself. He thought about how pleasant it was to spontaneously take a walk. He couldn't do that at Hwangi, not without a rifle anyway. He breathed deeply when he reached the sand, tasting salt in the air, feeling like the foreigner he was. He slipped his hands into his pockets, taking in the morning. He had been walking for 15 minutes when he spotted a cat crouched on top of a dune, next to a deck that was under repair, the steps to the beach still unfinished. At the farm there had been barn cats, but this one looked as though it spent most of its time indoors. Just then, a small white dog raced past him, barreling toward a flock of seagulls that burst into the air like a small explosion. The dog eventually veered toward the dune, spotted the cat, and took off like a rocket. The cat jumped up to the deck as the dog scrambled up to the dune in pursuit, both of them vanishing from sight. A minute later, he thought he heard the distant screech of car tires, followed by the sound of a dog yelping and crying. He glanced behind him. Halfway down the beach, he saw a woman standing near the water, no doubt the dog's owner, her gaze fixed on the ocean. He guessed she was the same woman he'd spotted the night before, but she was too far away to have seen or heard what had happened. Hesitating briefly, True started after the dog, his feet slipping in the sand as he scaled the dune. Stepping onto the deck, he followed the walkway, eventually reaching a new set of steps leading on one side up to the house's deck, and on the other down to the ground.
He went down, winding between two houses that were similar in style to the one where he was staying.
Climbing over a low retaining wall, he continued to the road. No car in sight. No hysterical people or dog lying in the road either. That was good news as an initial matter. He knew from experience that wounded animals often sought shelter if they were still able to move, nature's way of allowing them to heal while hiding from predators. He walked along one side of the road, searching the bushes and around trees. He didn't see anything. Crossing the street, he repeated the process, and eventually came across the dog standing near a hedge, its rear leg bobbing up and down. The dog was panting and shaking, whether from pain or shock, True couldn't tell. He debated whether to go back to the beach and try to find the woman, but he was afraid the dog might hobble away to parts unknown. Removing his sunglasses, he squatted down and held his hand out. "Hey there," he said, keeping his voice calm and steady. "You all right?" The dog tilted its head, and True slowly began to inch toward it, speaking in low, steady tones. When True was close, the dog stretched out, trying to sniff his hand, before taking a couple of hesitant steps forward. When the dog finally seemed convinced of his good intentions, it relaxed. True stroked its head and checked for blood. Nothing. On its collar tag, True saw the name Scotty. "Hi, Scotty," he said. "Let's get you back to the beach, shall we? Come on." It took some coaxing, but Scotty finally began to follow True back toward the dune. He was limping, but not to the point where True thought anything might be broken. When Scotty stopped at the retaining wall, True hesitated before finally reaching down and scooping him into his arms. He carried him between the houses and up the steps to the walkway, then eventually over the dune. Scanning the beach, he spotted the woman, much nearer now. True eased down the dune and started toward her. The morning remained bright, but the woman seemed even brighter, amplified by the sunny yellow fabric of her sleeveless top, fluttering in the wind. He watched as the gap between them continued to close, studying her as she drew near. Despite the confusion on her face, she was beautiful, with untamed auburn hair and eyes the color of turquoise. And almost at once, something inside him began to stir, something that made him feel a bit nervous, the way he always felt in the presence of an attractive woman.
Hope. Hope stepped from the back deck to the walkway that led over the dune, trying to keep her coffee from spilling. Scotty, her aptly named Scottish Terrier, strained at the leash, eager to reach the beach. "Stop pulling," she said. The dog ignored her. Scotty had been a gift from Josh, her boyfriend of the past 6 years, and he barely listened on his best days. But since arriving at the cottage the day before, he'd been positively wild. His paws scuffled madly against the sandy steps as they descended to the beach, and she reminded herself that she needed to bring him to another one of those weekend obedience training programs, though she doubted it would do any good. He'd flunked out of the first two already. Scotty, the sweetest and cutest dog in the world, seemed to be a bit of a dim bulb, bless his heart. Then again, maybe he was just stubborn. Because Labor Day had come and gone, the beach was quiet, most of the elegant homes dark. She saw someone jogging near the pier. In the opposite direction, a couple strolled near the water. She leaned over, setting the foam cup in the sand while she released Scotty from the leash, watching as her dog sprinted away. She doubted anyone would care. Last night, she'd seen two other dogs off-leash, and in any case, there weren't too many people around to complain. Hope started walking and took a sip of her coffee. She hadn't slept well. Usually, the endless roar of the waves lulled her immediately to sleep, but not last night. She'd tossed and turned, woken multiple times, and had finally given up for good when sunlight began streaming into her room. At least the weather was perfect, with blue skies and a temperature more typical of early autumn than late summer. On the news last night, they had predicted storms over the weekend, and her friend Ellen was crazy with worry. Ellen was getting married on Saturday, and both the wedding and the reception were supposed to be outdoors at the Wilmington Country Club, somewhere near the 18th Green. Hope figured there was probably a backup plan. No doubt they'd be able to use the clubhouse. But when Ellen had called last night, she'd nearly been in tears. Hope had been sympathetic on the phone, but it hadn't been easy. Ellen was so caught up in her own worries that she hadn't so much as asked how Hope was doing. In a way, that was probably a good thing. The last thing Hope wanted to talk about right now was Josh. How was she supposed to explain that Josh was going to be a no-show for the wedding? Or that, as disappointing as a rained-out wedding could be, there were definitely worse things. Right now, Hope was feeling a bit overwhelmed by life in general, and spending the week alone at the cottage wasn't helping. Not only because Josh wasn't around, but because it was probably the last week she'd ever spend here. Her parents had listed the cottage with a realtor earlier in the summer, and they'd accepted an offer 10 days ago. She understood why they were selling, but she was going to miss this place. Growing up, most of her summers and holidays had been spent here, and every nook and cranny held memories. She could recall washing the sand from her feet with a garden hose, watching storms from the window seat in the kitchen, and the scent of fish or steaks being grilled in the barbecue on the back deck. She remembered swapping late-night secrets with her sisters in their shared room, and it was here that she'd kissed a boy for the very first time. She had been 12 years old, and his name was Tony. For years, his family had owned the cottage 3 doors down. She'd had a crush on him most of the summer, and after they'd split a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, he'd kissed her in the kitchen while her mom had been watering plants on the deck. The memory still made her smile, and she wondered what the new owners intended to do with the place. She wanted to imagine that they wouldn't change a thing, but she wasn't naive. During her childhood, the cottage had been one of many similarly sized homes along this stretch of shoreline. Now there were only a few cottages remaining. In recent years, Sunset Beach had been discovered by the wealthy, and more than likely the cottage would be raised and a new, much larger home constructed, like the 3-story monstrosity right next door. It was the way of the world, she supposed, but it nonetheless felt like part of her was being raised as well. She knew it was crazy thinking, a little too, woe is me, and she chided herself for it. Playing the martyr wasn't like her. Until recently, she'd always thought of herself as a glass half full, because today is a new day kind of girl. And why not? In most ways, her life had been blessed. She had loving parents and 2 wonderful older sisters. She was an aunt to 3 boys and 2 girls, who were a source of constant joy and surprise to her. She'd done well in school, and she enjoyed her work as a trauma nurse in the ER at Wake County Medical Center. Despite the few pounds she wanted to lose, she was healthy. She and Josh, an orthopedic surgeon, had been dating since she was 30, and she loved him. She had good friends and owned her own condominium in Raleigh, not far from her parents. From the outside, everything looked just peachy. So why was she feeling so wonky right now? because it was one more trying thing in an already trying year, beginning first and foremost with her dad's diagnosis, that particular soul-crushing bombshell arriving in April. Her dad was the only one who hadn't been surprised at the news from the doctor. He'd known something was amiss when he no longer had the energy to jog in the woods behind his house. Her dad had exercised in those woods for as long as she could remember. Despite the construction engulfing Raleigh, the area had been designated a greenbelt, which was one of the reasons her parents had bought their home in the first place. Over the years, various developers had tried to overturn the city's decision, promising jobs and tax revenue. They did so without success, partly because her father had opposed them at every meeting of the city council. Her dad adored the woods. Not only did he run there in the mornings, but after he finished at the school, he would walk the paths he'd followed earlier in the morning. When she was a little girl, she would tag along with him after work, chasing butterflies or tossing sticks, hunting for crawdads in the small creek that wove toward the path in places. Her dad was a high school science teacher who knew the names of every bush and tree they passed. He would point out the differences between a southern red oak and a black oak, and in that instant, the distinctions were as obvious as the color of the sky. Later, though, if she attempted it on her own, the information jumbled together